I want to just quickly read for you a bit about the first pro-choice demonstration that we know of in all of Canada, which took place in Vancouver on Valentine's Day, 1970. It had been proposed by a phenomenal woman named Betsy Woods, who just has the keenest political mind I've come across in many a day. She felt that Valentine's Day was the day to have this demonstration. And years later, Betsy Wood is still elated by the march's success. It's true that bystanders joined in on that march. I've met people since who joined in on that abortion march. Really straight types joined in. She said this because it was the hippie period. The TV coverage was fantastic in Woods's view. The woman who wrote it up for the Georgia Strait, named Janine Mitchell, noticed, too, the reactions of observers. A lot of people laughed at first glance, and many men in particular gave us the kind of tolerantly amused smile parents give children. But as they got to reading such signs as 12,000 die from illegal abortions a year in North America, smiles faded. It wasn't a joke, after all. These nutty women and long-haired men parading down the streets and holding up traffic, beating old pots with metal spoons. Half a dozen anti-abortionists tried to blot out the banners that said, "Abortion is our right," with smaller placards claiming, "Abortion is murder." Mitchell reported that while some bystanders were confused by the conflicting signs, relations between the opposing factions were quite peaceful. She gave an example. When a guy with an anti-abortion sign crowded into prominence at a sidewalk skit performance, pro-choice skit performance, the girl playing the butcher put her arm around him, holding a sign beside his. It read, "Old Wives' Tales." Well, I've told you about going to Ottawa, which was another of the Women's Caucus events. And I just want to give you a brief idea of the opposition that we got. Probably the best known anti-abortionist at that time in Canada was a man named Joseph Bourassa. He started out as highways minister for the NDP in Manitoba, but he soon quit to campaign full-time for a ban on abortions. In 1971, he was speaking on a talk radio show, and Bourassa told a caller that teenage girls wouldn't need abortions, quote, "if they'd keep their hot pants on, or maybe we'll do to them what we do to dogs and have them spayed." So it was that kind of, there's only one word for it, misogynist attitude that was opposing women's right to choose. And I think you will find in my book and by talking to anyone from that period, even today, that the objective of the anti-abortion movement is not so much to say to ban abortions or to on behalf of the fetus, but to crush women. They are out to be as ruthless towards women as the Taliban are to women in Afghanistan. We went on to, I'll have to back up for just a minute. Dr. Morgenthaler had a very strong fight on his hands. And he went through real misery in his effort to keep his clinics open. The clinics were considered illegal because women didn't have to grovel before a hospital therapeutic abortion committee. Finally, in January of 1988, the Canadian Supreme Court ruled in his favor and said, "Yeah, to put restrictions on access to abortion, to make abortions illegal in a clinic when they were supposedly legal in a hospital was against the Charter of Rights, and the Canadian Supreme Court struck down the abortion law. That opened the way for a coalition of feminists in Vancouver to open BC's first abortion clinic in November 1988. It was called Every Woman's Health Center. Every Woman's Health Center is still there. It's now in its 17th year of operation. But when we started out, about 7 to 9 of us, we had no money, and only one person had any medical training at all. She was a nurse. And here we were going to take on the whole system. Well, we managed to open this clinic through donations. People dug into their pockets, gave us $20 when they could, and somehow we raised the money to put a down payment on a building. And you may know that building. It was at 44th and Victoria. The clinic has moved now. It's in a different location. But we bought the building because we couldn't find any place to rent to us to open an abortion clinic. And we opened this clinic despite all predictions that we would fail. Well, that was the beginning. Pretty soon, the anti-abortionists, well, from the very beginning, from opening day, there were protesters outside every single day, no matter what the weather. There were people with their picket signs. We respected their right to express their views. They were never asked to leave. But that wasn't enough. And about 6 weeks after the opening rally, we had our first blockade. This was a group that called itself Operation Rescue, which had first begun in the U.S. and had now spread to Canada. And one morning when the staff arrived, this is what they saw. Early on Thursday, December 15th, 1988, a group began assembling in the dark along East 44th Avenue. In front of Every Woman's Health Center. When the first clinic staffers arrived around 8 o'clock, they found a crowd of 80 to 100 forming a human wall half a block long. They sang hymns as they jammed shoulder to shoulder behind a large sign that said, "Rescue in Progress." They wore cards around their necks saying, "Baby Jane Doe" or "Baby John Doe." Operation Rescue was in town, and the Vancouver clinic blockade season had begun. We knew they'd come sooner or later, but the sight of them was definitely chilling. It was obviously impossible to enter the clinic, and the staff did not attempt to cross the picket line. Joy Thompson, one of the staffers for the clinic, went to the payphone on the corner and called 911. Two police officers in an unmarked car nearby made no move to identify themselves to her, and they continued sitting there throughout the morning. To get help, Thompson and Marg Panton crossed Victoria Drive to the upstairs offices of City Outside Workers, QP Local 1004. Without hesitation, the local freed telephones for them, and for hours its offices served as a warm safe house with coffee in the pot and no questions asked. I wanted especially to mention that because throughout all these years, most of the money we got to carry out our campaigns came from donations from the labor movement. They were our strongest supporters and were greatly in their debt. Ten women were scheduled to have abortions that day. Panton began phoning to describe the situation and give them the option of rescheduling. Most wanted to come anyway and were willing to wait until the blockaders were gone, although no one knew when that might be. Well, they hung around until finally the police began carrying them away at about 2:30 in the afternoon. However, as soon as the police arrived with the paddy wagon, the blockaders went limp and they had to be carried one at a time. It took two or three police persons for each blockader, and it took a couple of hours to load up the paddy wagon and carry them off. So they managed to make the women who were waiting for abortions wait all that time without any food. They had to fast because they were going to be receiving anesthetic. That was the first of four major blockades and several smaller ones, and they caused us no end of trouble. But they also caused trouble in the courts, because when, in fact, they really wanted very much to go to court, and there they were going to win the case and carry on to the Supreme Court and knock down all these decisions in favor of women's rights. So they allowed themselves to be arrested for breaking an injunction that we had had to obtain to prevent blockades. And they showed up at the in the court system, where they told the judge, "We don't have to obey the laws. God told us that it's okay to do what we do." Now, somehow the judges weren't impressed. They were really pretty lenient. Some of the blockaders were sentenced to jail terms, but very short ones, they only had to serve on weekends or alternate weekends over the period of months. They got off pretty easily. But the injunction did succeed in driving them away, and eventually they quit blockading us. I just wanted to read you one other little story about the clinic. After the blockade ceased, we had a break-in. This was on a Sunday in 1990. And the major damage was to the machine used for abortions. We couldn't manage to borrow one from any hospital in this region. However, by the next day, we had located one that we could borrow from Washington State. That was great, except it was only 600 kilometers away. So staffers Joy Thompson and Mark Panton were struck off to go get it. Thompson put on her cowboy boots, arranged babysitting for her kids, and the two set out in a borrowed van around 6 p.m. on Monday, February 26th. Clients would be coming in the next morning at 9 o'clock, so they had about 15 hours to make a 14-hour trip. With only one pit stop, they pulled up at the home of the Yakima Clinic's director about 2 a.m. She was waiting with the aspirator. None of them had ever met before, and the Vancouver women were full of gratitude that the Yakima women would hand over their precious spare aspirator on faith. They rigged a plywood ramp and pushed the aspirator up it into the van. Then, after brief and cheery goodbyes, "Send it back when you're done with it," the hell for leather drive back to Vancouver began. The tricky part came at the border. Before they'd left, the advice of Canada Customs had been sought, and it was that even though the aspirator was only on loan, it must be declared at the border and duty paid for it. When the van got there at a dark, blear hour, there were two cars in the line ahead of it. "If we declare the aspirator," Thompson and Panton agreed, "then we'll have to unload it for inspection, fill out forms in triplicate, and blah, blah, blah." There wasn't time for that. Should they just not say anything? The problem was, it wasn't a small machine. It was noticeable in the back of the van, a large metal contraption with bottles and tubes attached. "Got anything to declare, girls?" asked the customs officer. They explained they had no purchases, but the fellow could see the aspirator just behind the driver's seat. "Well, we have a piece of medical equipment here, but it's just on loan." He could tell they didn't mean a bandage or a syringe. Taking a deep breath, Thompson explained about the break-in at Every Woman's Health Center and the lucky find of an aspirator in Washington State. She didn't actually ask to be waved through, but she described the roster of clients waiting for them in Vancouver. Incredibly, the tough guy said he'd heard about the break-in and he thought it was dreadful. Then he said something like, "Well, hurry up then and go on, but don't do it again." I hope you may want to read the book, and there are some for sale over on the table. I want to leave time for questions and discussion, and I want to leave time for you to hear a bit from Joyce Arthur. So I'm going to ask her to step forward now.